Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Healthy Peaceful podcast. I am so glad you're joining me this week as I continue my series on Ayurveda, an ancient system of wellness from India that truly is meaningful and practical to our modern lives. As you know, the state of well-being in the US is currently not optimal. Much of our healthcare paradigm is based on we won't fix it until it's broken, with very little emphasis placed on how stress and the accelerated pace of our lives impacts our health. Ayurveda is a paradigm that asks us to step up, to consider how each and every aspect of our lives influences our health. Instead of focusing on disease, Ayurveda attunes us to the subtle imbalances that percolate in our mind and physiology. When we are attuned, we gain the capacity to align and realign. We become powerful instead of powerless. We gain the opportunity for perfect health. Every week, I explore these principles with a fascinating guest who is on the path, or I share what's resonating for me. Thank you for supporting this podcast and for being a co-creator of, in conceiving of, and participating in the new paradigm, a healthy, peaceful world.
Good afternoon, Kamesh. How are you today?
I'm great. And you?
Wonderful. This is Noreen at the Healthy Peaceful Podcast. And today I have a wonderful guest. We're going to talk about the interrelationship of yoga and Ayurveda. And today I have with me Kamesh Ginger Hooven. And I just want to take a moment and properly introduce you. Please correct me with any details. You are originally from Tennessee. You currently live in Guatemala, and you have for several decades. You are the proprietor of a restaurant, a very successful restaurant, which you've run for a number of years, called Cafe Condesa. And you also have a B&B. The name is escaping me. Wonderful. And you teach yoga there, and you also offer the retreats there, and guests can stay there privately as well. Mm-hmm. You decided to start studying yoga and Ayurveda, and you studied with a number of very well-known teachers and scholars. You did your yoga teacher training with George Feuerstein. I believe he's no longer living now.
Right.
But yes.
Yeah.
And you also studied at Mount Medana with Yogi Baba Hari Das. Mm-hmm. You currently teach at Mount Medana, both in the Ayurvedic program and the yoga program. You're a certified Ayurvedic practitioner by Nama and a registered yoga teacher, I think 700 hours, and also a yoga therapist. Now that's a mouthful. Did I leave anything out?
I hope not.
That's great. That's wonderful. Well, I'm so excited to have the opportunity to speak with you and to really explore the intersection of Ayurveda and yoga. I get to start with, you know, many people come to yoga for the asanas, and then they're introduced a little bit to Ayurveda, or they've at least become familiar with the word. And through yoga, they may be embodying some of the Ayurvedic concepts, but not really fully aware that that's what's happening. But if you could, in one sentence, or even more if you like, describe what you consider you know, the importance of yoga to Ayurveda and Ayurveda to yoga.
Well, these sister sciences go back millennia, right? And I think there's no real separation of the two at the heart of it, at the belief that all of creation is made of the five elements, and we also are made of those five elements. And whether it be through yoga and yogic practices or Ayurveda, just recognizing our true immortality and working to keep healthy bodies and minds, but also realizing that it's a journey, all of it. I feel like in India, all of the yogis knew Ayurveda, the basic principles, because their teachers had taught them, and all of the vaidyas, all of the Ayurvedic doctors, definitely know yoga and prescribe pranayama or a meditation or an asana, maybe not like a hot yoga class, but just something that's particular to that area of the body. So I think the sister sciences have used one another throughout the millennium to complement one another. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are differences. Yoga is looking for liberation, and Ayurveda is looking also for liberation, but with a healthy body and a healthy mind. And yoga will also say you pretty much need a healthy body and healthy mind to get through a lot of the yogic practices. But there's a lot, often we view it as a lot more austerity in the practices of yoga. Yeah.
Okay, great. That's
hopefully
that's,
that answered your question.
No, that's great. So it's really nuanced, but would you say that Ayurveda is supportive of yoga in terms of, perhaps not the way that we think of yoga, or many people think of only yoga as asanas, but yoga as a path, a spiritual tradition, including asanas. Would it be correct to say that you feel that Ayurveda supports the yogic path, or would
definitely
some? Okay.
But I think that it often doesn't if you don't have the proper yoga teacher, right? Because if a yoga teacher is not taking into account someone's Ayurvedic prakriti or vikriti, their nature or their imbalance, whichever of the two, and help them get something that's perfect for them for balancing, then they can be doing more wrong than good. I mean, if you have a pitta in menopause and you send her to a hot yoga class, she's only going to be worse, because you didn't understand that like increases like and opposites decrease. So you need to pull her out of that, put her in some restorative, or put her in a yoga nidra class, and let coolness prevail, right? So they complement one another beautifully. If you look at yoga and its practices through the lens of Ayurveda, and you take the balance of, is it hot? Is it cold? Is it rough? Is it soft? Is it like all of the gunas, we call them the qualities. Mm-hmm. If you look at those gunas in terms of balancing the individual, rather than thinking only in terms of group asana classes, then of course Ayurveda supports yoga, and yoga supports Ayurveda.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, it sounds like if the yoga practitioner has a knowledge of Ayurveda, and even the person, the individual, the student, him or herself, that they're going to have a greater awareness of what yoga postures, what yoga, even temperature, and the qualities that you describe are really going to be supportive versus either agitating or dulling or just really bringing them further out of balance.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Okay. All right. When we talk about Ayurveda, you know, many times the key word seems to be balance. What does that word mean to you in working with clients and students? You know, what does balance mean?
Well, in Ayurveda, we have the five elements, as I mentioned earlier, and everyone is made up of a predominance of some of those elements, some or one or some sort of a predominance. That's called our prakriti. We often break it down into doshas, but the doshas basically are the five elements, so it's just a little bit easier to talk about it as the five elements. So earth, our grounding element, water, liquidity in the body, fire, energy in the body, air, movement in the body, and space, all of the space that we have in our bodies and our organs and our outside part of us. So if we're looking at ourselves in terms of the five elements, then when it comes to balancing the five elements, if you're lethargic and you can't get up in the morning and you don't want to practice and then you've got too much earth and water, which is mud, right? Just too much heaviness, too much kapha, if you look at the dosha, so that you need to lighten it up with a little more energy, maybe a little more fire. You might need a little more movement, a little more air element. So one of the basic siddhantas or principles is like increases like and opposites decrease. So if I become aware that I have too much heat in my body, I'm looking for something cool, maybe not cold, because going to the exact extreme and opposite will also create a boomerang effect. So we don't want that. But if I've been having ice cold water and a meal every day and have bad digestion, then I might bring it to room temperature water for a few months and see if that has an effect. So it's always looking for the place that you can find the happy medium. You want to balance to your own nature. There's no one nature that is better than anything. It just is what it is. So if you were born with more fire, then you need to keep that fire right where it is. And so if your fire dies down, people will begin to ask you, are you feeling sad? Are you feeling depressed? If your digestive fire dies down and you go from a nice daily bowel movement to one every 3 or 4 days, you've got too much air going on. And so it's really learning how to use the principles of Ayurveda and the principles of yoga to find overall balance in our physical body, in our mental body, spiritual body.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I love the, many times we'll hear that, you know, you want it, and coming back to balance, you know, coming back to, you know, the Vikriti and the Prakriti being your natural state of balance and the Vikriti being your current state, which may be slightly imbalanced. But I love how you described it, which was you really want to balance your own nature, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, that's really beautiful. I never heard it quite described that way. So thank you for that. Thinking about yoga in terms of balance, many times we'll use the breath with clients or students to explore balance. Are there particular, and in yoga, it's called pranayama. Are there any particular breath exercises or breath work that you like to do with clients or in working with clients?
I'll give you the Ayurvedic answer. The Ayurvedic sure. answer is it depends. It depends.
Yeah.
That's everything,
sure.
right? So we have heating yeah. pranayama, like Ujjayi and Bhramari pranayama, the bee humming, the victorious breath, Ujjayi. We have cooling pranayama, like Shitali and Sitkari. We have balancing pranayama. We have pranayama that have holes and use locks, which require a lot more stamina of the individual. And so it really depends. I have a class for the beginning students called Pranayama and Meditation for the Doshas, just learning how to see what pranayama is going to bring back balance. Like I said, if we have someone hot and she's doing Ujjayi during her asana practice, she's only exacerbating the issue. You know, she should stop every 3 or 4 postures and be still and breathe a cooling breath, Shitali or Sitkari, and cool down. And someone who's feeling lethargic should be adding Ujjayi to their asana practice, or sitting before they even think of asana and doing some heating breaths to just clear up that kapha, that inert part of our bodies that sometimes will predominate.
Exactly.
And our yoga practices too, you know, asanas that put pressures on the seats of the doshas. The doshas all have seats along the GI tract, basically. Mm-hmm. And so when we take an asana and put a pressure there for a little while, then it has a great tendency to make a complete difference. We bring the pressure in and it sort of self-regulates and brings balance about. So that's a super important concept of bringing balance. It doesn't mean like vinyasa, the word vinyasa just means choreography, where you coordinated the movement and the breath and everything together. It's not one set thing of any particular poses. But the vinyasa, the tying all the poses together, is a relatively recent phenomenon. And it's more like, you know, you might tell someone that has indigestion problems to be on the floor on their belly and do cobra for 5 minutes. And really bringing that awareness and that energy into the low belly area, right? So again, it depends on the individual and where you want to place the energy and the balance. Yeah.
Sure. Yeah. You use the word seat. So could you elaborate on what you mean right. by that? And maybe using the example that you gave about the student with the cobra pose and
right.
Or,
so
or another said, example.
The seat of kapha is the upper part of the GI tract, so the chest region. So it's the esophagus, it's the it can be the head region, the lung region. But when we look at the GI tract, it's the esophagus and the fundus of the stomach, the upper part of the stomach where all of the mucus is produced. And then when we go a little further down, the duodenum into the small intestine, is the seat of pitta. And so that's a seat of fire. And then the colon, our large intestine, is the seat of vata. And so when we are balancing, we can put pressure on the colon, which would be like child's pose, laying down and creating a deep crease in the area of your colon between your hips and your torso. So that would put pressure into the colon area, or lying upside down and doing happy baby pose, bringing your knees into your chest, creating pressure in that colon area on both sides. Cobra on the belly would be good, or makarasan, which is alligator on the belly. And then a back bend would be really healthy and good for bringing some energy into the chest region. So a back bend, also cobra itself, because even sphinx poses. So let's just say they don't want to work so much on the belly. They don't have a strong belly yet. So we work on the chest region, and they're in sphinx pose with their elbows and forearms all the way on the floor, supporting themselves. Mm-hmm. But the pressure and the change is happening in their thoracic spine, which is where they have ribs, is they're finding that curve that's putting pressure into the chest area.
Mm, okay, beautiful, beautiful. So in the case of like a pose like happy baby, if in terms of putting pressure on in the colon area, would that be vata being the seat of vata is in the colon? So would that be a good pose for a person who is experiencing a vata imbalance generally?
Yeah, okay. If it's too much vata, right? Uh-huh. Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely. Okay. So that's, we have one, if you do like happy baby with one leg at a time, that pose is called Pavan Muktasan, which Pavan means wind release pose. So it's really working in the colon where you're collecting all of those gases and air, right? And so putting a little bit of pressure there helps to release those gases.
Yeah, that's it's amazing. It truly is a science, there's no doubt. Let's see what else I had here. Shoulder stand. A particular pose. You talked about some of them, but some of the poses are not only are they going to be balancing from an Ayurvedic perspective, but they also have specific effects on the organs in the body.
Absolutely, absolutely. One of my favorite poses for women, especially that are over 40, so they are starting to risk osteopenia, is we call it mountain pose. It's off of our mountain. It's usually called downward facing dog. And so that particular pose is a weight-bearing pose. It's not to be done if you have glaucoma, eye pressure issues, if you have high or low blood pressure that's totally uncontrolled, or if you are on the first few days of your menstrual cycle. Those are the people who shouldn't be inverting, period. But if you can invert, then building up on a daily basis to downward facing dog or mountain pose. Then it's a weight bearing pose, so it grows and lays down new bone. And it's a pose that's really wonderful for putting a different weight on the organs. The organs are upside down, moving upside down from the hike at the hip. So everything is falling down against the diaphragm, and the diaphragm is having to work more efficiently to take the breath. And the organs are being massaged because of being upside down in the diaphragm, working differently. So it's just a really good pose. I always encourage people to try 30 seconds, see if they can make it at 30 seconds, and then build their way up to a minute, all the way up to 5 minutes, and then maybe 10 minutes. Because it's a perfect pose for the body just being really still while everything that's happening is doing it differently in the body.
That's beautiful. So it's everything is in a different position than it typically is when we're either in a seated position or walking or sitting.
Right. So the legs are still on the floor. So like a full inversion, sure, which could be like Viparita Karani Mudra, which is often called topsy-turvy pose. So that particular pose, it's a great inversion if people are inverting. It's often called legs up the wall, but it's a matter of putting your bottom higher up than your throat. Mm. So as long as you're raising up and like sitting on a bolster or a couple of pillows or a block or so, and lifting the hips higher than the throat. But for someone who does have high blood pressure or has glaucoma or has any of the issues with which you not want to invert, they can do legs up the wall with their bottom on the floor and just elevate the legs a little. It's kind of like, just put the legs over a chair. You don't have to go all the way up the wall. You do not have to be at a 90 degree angle. You can be at a 40 degree angle. You can be a 30 degree angle. But just that little bit of lifting the legs higher than the hips is also allowing the lymph to drain differently and allowing the body to be much more efficient in its distribution of the lymph.
Yeah, that's beautiful. So if a person is not able to get into a full shoulder stand or headstand, then they can use legs up the wall or legs on a chair, and they're still going to receive significant benefits from that.
Absolutely.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, let's see. How about a pose like the tree pose? Mm-hmm. Thinking about that from both an Ayurvedic and a therapeutic perspective, how would you look at tree pose in terms of working with clients?
Well, first, because it's a balance pose on one leg, I'd make sure that the client has a chair or a wall close by. Sometimes that's all they need, is just to know that they're not stuck in the middle of the room and don't have anything to hold on to, because that's not really good for the brain either. So knowing that there's a support there, and then looking for, it's very engaging to the pelvic floor, which is of course stimulating to the chakra system. So it's engaging the pelvic floor. The belly has to be engaged to protect the low back, and then the leg externally rotated and all of the length moving up the spine. So it puts a lot of pressure in the pelvic basket, which is again the seat of Pitta, but it's very balancing for Vata because it requires you to root down. It requires you to really grow some tendrils down to Mother Earth, right? So it's a very good pose for all three doshas, truly. Mm-hmm. Vata, Pitta, Kapha, all five elements can be beautifully balanced there. And the higher you take it, the more you take it, of course, the more challenging you make it, the more that it's better for Kapha. And sometimes it can be Vata aggravating. Like if you've got your arms all up in the air and wiggling around,
right. It's not. Yeah, you're increasing the air element there. That's wonderful. So certain poses, like Pri in certain cases, can be tridoshic, meaning balancing for all the doshas. Mm-hmm. Are there particular poses, maybe talk about three poses that you consider to be pragmatic or beneficial for each dosha, with certain variations possibly.
Well, the best pose of all is Shavasana.
I thought of that one. Yeah. I thought, well, it's got to be good for everyone.
Babaji says that's the hardest pose to do because people do not know how to relax truly.
Oh,
you see tense jaws. You see marks on their forehead. You see their hands are tense, or their feet or their legs are tense. It's just so hard to relax. So a perfect tridoshic balancing, relaxing pose would be learning properly how to do Shavasana, which is a challenge. Otherwise, any kind of active pose is good for kapha, anything that's moving. So for example, let's just take triangle pose. Triangle pose is good, or warrior two, something that's relatively simple and people do it all the time. So if you do repetition, that's good for kapha because they're moving in and out and in and out and adding some of that fire that's necessary and movement principle into that kapha inertia that they might have created. Someone who's got too much vata going on, too much air and space element, then you might want them to just go into the pose and stay and take their 10 breaths right there, not move. Just staying, stabilizing, feeling those tendrils growing down through Mother Earth, just being super stable. And for the pitta, you want he or she to back off their intensity. So when they get to 100% of the pose, you want to say, can you relax 20%? Can you do this pose at 80% of effort? Can you relax your back? Can you extend your spine? So really just trying to look at the elements themselves and create the opposite if you need it for balance.
Well, that's, you bring up the words relaxation, and that's used a lot in the asana practice, that you want to find that it's a it's the polarity between effort and relaxation. How do you look at those words and bring those into Ayurveda in terms of effort and relaxation?
I mean, it's part of Ayurveda, you know, effort is the fire element and relaxation or letting go would be the earth element. So it's already there, you know, that grounding, that rooting, that stabilizing, that's earth. And then the fire of the effort, right?
Absolutely.
That metabolic effort, the physical effort that it takes to do something, that's the pitta.
Absolutely. That's great. I like that. In terms of the classes that you're currently, are you currently teaching at your B&B? Or I know you're teaching online right now, right?
I'm just teaching a couple of classes online every week, right?
Okay.
I teach
a
couple of classes, and I have a YouTube channel that's got a ton of free classes.
Okay. All right. What are your favorite classes to teach?
Oh, I love teaching everything. I love teaching Samkhya philosophy. I love teaching the anatomy of the breath. I love teaching all the anatomy classes. I love teaching asana, pranayama. I love to teach meditation, the different types of meditation, you name it. There's nothing I don't love teaching. I may not know enough about a subject yet to teach it, but it doesn't mean I'm not reading it and trying to learn more about it.
Right. Well, they say the best way to the best way to learn something is to teach it.
Absolutely.
In terms of the classes that you're working, your yoga and your other classes with the public, I mean, I know now we're on Zoom and we're not interacting. How are they different than the classes that you're teaching at Mount Madonna? So if you were...
Well, no, at Mount Madonna, I'm teaching on Zoom too right now. So
okay. Oh, that's true. Yeah. Everything's Zoom. Yeah.
We've created a really wonderful cohort for our advanced yoga studies. And I feel just as close to those students on Zoom. I would like a hug, but sometimes I feel like I get one. And I've been brought to tears with stuff that people have shared. And I feel that we've managed to create a cohort of lovely spiritual seekers, in spite of the limitations. You know, it's our own limitation that we impose on it. I am not this body. You are not your body. And there is that space element of Akash, that space element where we are in the same space. The space and time that we've created are just creations. They are not the reality, right? Mm-hmm. So if I really believe that, then I can go across space and time and check in.
Yeah, that's beautiful. That's beautiful. It's really wonderful. You're doing some Zoom classes for the public as well, yoga classes currently.
Yeah, I do yoga classes every Tuesday and Thursday on Zoom, free.
Okay. Any particular theme for those classes, or what is your approach in terms of your own yoga teaching with students, not Ayurvedic and yoga students, but the public for the most part?
It depends. It totally depends. Yeah. Sometimes I pick a pose and I work toward that pose, warming up the parts of the body that are really needed with the actions that are needed for the apex pose that we're going to do that day. Some days I wake up and feel a certain way that what I thought I was going to do the night before, I'm not going to do at all. It depends. I feel more like I filter the teachings instead of I don't really plan the teachings very well.
That's beautiful.
I teach a 75-minute class though. So it's an hour of action. It's pranayama, meditation, asana, and 15 minutes of discussion every time.
Oh, that's really wonderful. So at the end of your classes, you have 15 minutes of discussion.
Every time.
That's great. And what kind of questions come up?
Everything. Literally everything. You know, from the particular practice to a wonder about doing it to, lots of stuff comes up. It depends who's in the room, you know.
Right. Have there been any questions that have surprised you?
Maybe so, but over the 20 something years I've been teaching, no. Nothing surprises me.
Okay. Well, it sounds a lot, your teaching sounds a lot like, in a way, like cooking. You know, you get up that day, you thought you planned for something, but you're not really in the mood for that. So you shift.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Does your teaching change with the seasons?
Absolutely. My season changes with the climate every day. I'm here in Guatemala where we don't have heat. We don't have air conditioning. We have what God gives you every day. And if it's chilly in the morning, I'm going to do more of an active practice and explain to the students, it's cold where I am, so I'm going to warm up a little bit first, because they may be in a place where they have their heat on full blast, or they have radiators where you can't turn them down. So trying to be clear about why I'm doing what I'm doing. Right. I try to be clear about all the time about why I'm doing what I'm doing.
Yeah. That's great. That's perfect. And in your yoga classes, in the discussions that you have with students after the class, is any portion of that, are you trying to incorporate Ayurvedic principles? Or?
Absolutely. Anything they want to ask, all of them, most of them know me or I have a whole new set of folks from Eventbrite. So, but a lot of people know me and they know I'm an Ayurvedic practitioner and they know I teach all of our yoga teacher trainings. And they ask particular questions they want to understand, you know, after sometimes it takes people years of having studied with me before they actually can form the question that they probably had for many years, but it hadn't come all the way to the top.
Sure. They just weren't a question yet.
But yeah, the question just hadn't formed fully, but I could tell it's something they've been working on for a long time.
It's been percolating. Yeah, mm-hmm. That's great. You know, in Ayurveda, they talk about the gunas.
Mm-hmm.
My understanding is that particular word relates to kind of our mental state.
No, that particular word just means quality.
Quality, yes.
Yeah. So we have the three gunas that you're referring to, sattva, rajas, and tamas, which is not just your mental state. It's all our whole physical state as well. It's anything that's matter. It's all of prakriti. It's either sattva, rajas, or tamas, or some combination thereof. And out of that whole mental state of the five elements, then we also have all of the other gunas, the hot versus cold, the heavy versus light, the sour versus sweet, all of those, right?
Sure.
Any quality is called a guna.
Okay. And just talking about sattva, rajas, and tamas, my understanding is generally, in terms of balance, we really want to move towards sattva. Maybe you, first of all, do you agree with that statement? And if so, how would you describe sattva and compare it to rajas and tamas?
So sattva is often referred to as purity or balance. The word balance is often called sattva. So when you're looking for a sattvic lifestyle, you're looking for a balanced lifestyle. When you're looking for a sattvic practice or a sattvic meal, it means balanced. Tamasic is inert, is stable, is non-moving. It's our building blocks. It's our foundation. It's the heavy. The rajas is the activity. It's motion. It's all of the movement that happens in our world. So everything was in perfect balance before it became matter, when prakriti was just the concept. But as soon as Purush, or the consciousness principle, looked through the matter principle and created this third entity that we have here that we call reality, everything in our reality is balanced of tamas, rajas, or sattva. And when we, Dr. Singh, one of my Ayurveda professors, drew it for me, and I've drawn it now for many people. There's a little teeter-totter here, and this is sattva. And then there's the teeter-totter across the top. And on each side, you have another triangle, and one is rajas, and the other is tamas. And they're always, rajas and tamas are balancing back and forth. So sattva can actually dominate when all three are in balance. So if there's too much rajas, too much activity, too much movement, slow down. If there's too much inertia and you can't get off the couch, get up, get moving. It's the same thing as the like increases like, opposites decrease. But when you have rajas and tamas balanced, then sattva shines through on all. And nature itself, which is prakriti, is in balance.
Sure. Well, that's interesting, because it's not a matter of, it sounds like it's not a matter of eliminating rajas and tamas.
So that you
get to sattva, you know. It's about all these qualities are present, and it's about having them so that there's balanced. An interplay that's harmonious.
Yes, there is no getting rid of any of
sure.
them.
Sure. Okay.
It's all like right, physics. Wonderful. Everything just changes, but nothing's disappearing.
All right. Yes. So would you agree or disagree with this? The goal of yoga and Ayurveda is to make sattva the most predominant guna.
I agree that we all want sattva to be the predominant guna. That means that we are balanced and we are stable and we are able to move when we need to move, be stable when we need to move, be balanced. Mm-hmm. So I think any health science, is looking for sattva, whether they know it or not.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great. I want to talk about the mind. We spend a lot of time focused on the state of our body, and whether our body. Whether we're having health, whether we're feeling healthy, whether we're feeling energized. But we don't seem to really mentor the state of our mind, at least in the US, in the same manner. So maybe could you tell me a little bit in terms of from an Ayurvedic and a yogic perspective, how we should be thinking about our mind and really how we should be working toward balance and the significance of it to our overall health and maybe some tools.
Well, they're a little different the way that they're approached in both of the sister sciences. But in yoga, we have the four minds. We have buddhi, which is our intellect. We have ahankar, which is our ego, our eye sense. We have manas, which is our recording faculty. And we have, and the fourth one just went right out of my head for a moment. But it's all of the minds work together. We think in English of one mind, where it's been broken out into these functions that the mind has, recording and remembering, realizing that you're separate from someone else, realizing that you're the same as everyone else. That's our discriminating wisdom. And so all of those minds work together in yoga. And our goal is that they do work together, but that the sattvic state, which is sattva buddhi, or our discriminating wisdom rules. And Ayurveda, the same. We're looking for the sattvic state of mind. And by balancing our rajas and tamas all over in every aspect of our life, then hopefully we get to that. But the mind is not limited to just our it's not our thoughts. It's beyond our thoughts. So not just looking at, that's the other one, chitta, our mind field, where all the thoughts are. That's the other one, right? That's mm-hmm. the fourth mind.
Mm-hmm. Right, so, all the noise.
No, all the thoughts, literally. Every thought that ever existed, will ever exist, is in that chit. And so mm-hmm. we are not our thoughts. We are not our body. Mm-hmm. We are eternal wisdom, but we've forgotten. And so I think both yoga and Ayurveda give us tools to get back to that sattvic state.
Yes. Any specific tools? I mean, obviously, we can be using the yoga asanas, but are there other tools that come to mind or in working with clients in terms of, because when we think of a perfect state of health or at least optimum health, the mind is integral to that. So other than yoga asanas, are there other tools that you utilize with clients or students?
Them back to the beginning, mm-hmm. Noreen. I take them back to the yama and the niyama, which are right. the restraints and the observances. If you are practicing asana and you don't know about practicing ahimsa, which is non-harming, yeah. you're probably yeah. hurting yourself in your asana practice. If you right. don't know about cleanliness, saucha, if you don't know about contentment, looking for the positive things that we have, looking for all of the bounty and practicing gratefulness. If you don't know yeah. about tapas, which is just withholding, do you need that extra set of shoes? Must you purchase right now in the pandemic one more online thing when everything else is still in the closet? Just stopping. And so I go back with my clients to the very beginning of the yogic practices, which are the yama and the niyama, before you get to asana and pranayama and meditation, and really mm-hmm. have them pick a yama or a niyama and do that. Self-study, which is either you can study yourself, who am I, why am I, or you can study scriptures or read spiritual books or whatever you need to do to remind yourself that this is an existential issue about our beingness, and we're not alone. We all have those same existential issues, whether we call it that or not.
Yeah, absolutely. That's beautiful, because do you consider the yamas and niyamas to be truly necessary preparation for meditation practice?
They're the foundation. In the Hatha mm-hmm. Yoga Pradipika, the very first thing it says, they don't count the yama and the niyama in their eight limbs, and they have added shat karma and Shatkarma and Mudra, right? So they have two additional limbs, and they've left off the yam and the niyam. But they say in the very first part of the book, which is the best scriptural book, the Hatha Yoga Pradipika, about Hatha Yoga and the physical practices of asana and pranayam and meditation, they say this: the foundation of all that we do is the yam and niyam. That's what we're based on. Mm-hmm. So you can start into asana. What I love about asana, like what I love about yoga, it doesn't matter where you start to have other things revealed. So if you start at the yam and you might all of a sudden decide, oh, well, all of a sudden I'd like to do a posture. Or maybe you started a posture and you go, there's something more than this. I talked to my child today and I didn't get hooked, huh? This is working on another level. So no matter where you come into the practice, you start to realize that yoga is making changes in yourself on every level, as does Ayurveda.
Yeah. Yeah, that's really beautiful. And it's sort of like you're on a road and you can enter at many different places, but eventually some of those other experiences are going to, it's an expansion. So it's really beautiful. I like the part about not getting hooked. That's a good one too. Let's see. Mm-hmm. Are there particular kinds of meditation that you use with your students, or that, you know, for somebody starting out and wanting to meditate, would you use a mantra? Would you, or is it really
dependent?
I probably
start most people with the breath, just not controlling it, because it is not a pranayama. It's just describing it. So just a simple meditation of I'm inhaling, I'm exhaling, just noticing the breath. But it depends. It depends. Some people do well with a mantra. Some people, the mantra drives them crazy. Some people do really well with complete silence. Some people, the silence, they're off thinking about what they're having for dinner. It depends. And I really like to pull out of the client what sorts of things they favor for their quiet time. Some people call it meditation. Some people call it prayer. So just whatever will lead them into that quiet state of mind.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful. Okay. Let's see if there's anything else here. In working with your clients, are there any props or tools that you like to use, such as particularly in clients as they're aging, and like a chair, or are there particular things that you like to use in your yoga practice?
I think everyone has a chair, so a chair is great.
Sure. Okay.
I like to use the wall. I'm not big on a lot of props. I do like to have a block handy in case I need it to be an extension of my arm. I can't get my arm to the floor. I'd like to have it underneath the knee if the knee's feeling a little antsy that day. But you can grab a pillow, or you can get, you know, a blanket and fold it up. So I really try to work with what people have. As we've done more home practice, I just encourage people to just grab a book or grab anything they can grab. You know, if they have a chair close by, sometimes we'll use a chair. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. Wonderful. How is it different teaching students at Mount Madonna, teaching them yoga and Ayurveda versus working with private clients or the public?
There's no difference. I mean, everybody wants to learn, you know, there's no difference. Yeah.
Sure. Okay. Let's see what else I have here. I used to do Raja Yoga. Okay. Let's see. And your own personal practice, I know you, in reading your bio, you started practicing yoga and learning about Ayurveda, I think it's over 20 years ago. You said in around 2000. Mm-hmm. How has your own evolution, let's start with your yoga practice first and your teaching. How has it evolved over the years?
Well, my teaching is not my practice. That's the most important thing. Practice is different. My practice always consists of pranayama and meditation. It may or may not consist of asana that day, because I get plenty of physical exercise and stay strong. My teaching, I don't know, you'd have to ask my students about how it's varied. I feel like I've always had a focus on alignment and form for ease of the breath in the pose, for ease of the prana in the pose, for looking for the pranic effect of the pose. And I feel like I've been doing that forever, right? I feel things evolve and change, and I've changed my opinions on a few things over the years, I'm sure. There are some cues that I tell students never to give. But, you know, my practice is, I mean, it's the same thing pretty much every day. And some days I'll add an additional practice in the afternoon or evening if I have time, usually an extra meditation. I do asana, like I've done more asana since the pandemic because every day I have time now to have a little bit of an asana practice. Sometimes it's 15 minutes, sometimes it's an hour. It just depends. My pranayama, my meditation take about 30, 35 minutes every day. And then if I add an additional meditation in the afternoon, that's it.
Okay. And are there ways that you have worked to keep your yoga practice fresh?
Like I said, I don't really feel like I'm teaching. I feel like it kind of just comes through me and it just stays fresh. That's not me.
That's great. That's great. Okay. So how have things changed for you since the pandemic and Zoom in terms of your teaching?
I don't think it's changed very much. I mean, I mentioned to you earlier, I feel that the students are in the room with me when they're on Zoom. You know, I look at them before I go back to my mat and I come back and I chat with them after class. And, you know, sometimes you're in a class of 40 or 50 people and you're not having any kind of personal relationship with them until the end when they can ask you a few questions. So it doesn't feel that different to me.
All right. Yeah. Wonderful. Wonderful. And if somebody is new to Ayurveda, any particular things that they start with?
Reading Dr. Ladd's The Art of Self-Healing. That's the place Anything? Where anybody could benefit from it. Vasant Ladd.
Yes, Vasant Ladd. I'll include that in the show notes. Any other books or resources that you like for beginner students?
I don't have anything beginner anymore, so I just stick with Dr. Ladd.
No, that's a great one. It's nice and simple. It's a great introduction, no doubt. Your own teachers and mentors who have been in your yoga and your Ayurvedic practice and teachings, who have been your most significant teachers and mentors over the years?
Well, you mentioned them at the beginning. It's Georg Fairstein. And Baba Hari Das, who was my teacher for the last, I guess, 14 or so years, I still feel like I get taught by him constantly from the heavens. And I have some amazing Ayurvedic mentors, Dr. Sarita Shrestha and Dr. Maharsh Singh, Dr. Ladd, who I adore and appreciate, Dr. Suhas Kirshagar. We have so many wonderful teachers at Mount Madonna. We have this master faculty of amazing professors, and I'm lucky enough that I get to know them all. So I feel like I have a ton of benefit out there.
That's great. That's great. We hear a lot about brain health as people age, and we want to obviously stay on top of our game, stay sharp. In terms of yoga and Ayurveda, in terms of the clarity of the mind, the ability to focus, ability to recall, the ability to perform, you know,
Can inversion's great, because inversions send blood to your head, and all day long blood is going down from your head and your brain. And yes, there are the pumps, the natural pumps that help it. But if you can do an inversion, if you can even just sit on a chair and spread your legs enough to put your torso there and hang your head over, that's also good for the brain. But then be very careful as you're coming up, and not strain your low back. Use your arms as fulcrums and push yourself up with your hands. But sure, any way you can get blood to your head is a really good for the mind, and okay, especially in yoga practices. So Chashangasana, which is rabbit pose, or of course, all of the inverting poses are really good. And mountain pose, downward facing dog. Hastapadasana, hand to foot, forward fold. Lots of great poses that are good for brain health. There are lots of herbs. There are many rasayanas, which are rejuvenating herbs that work. Brahmi works directly on the brain. But you need to see a practitioner, not just decide you're going to go take a bunch of herbs.
Of course, of course. Yeah, you don't. You really want to have an herbal protocol, not, you know, not just create your own. In other words, great. Is there anything else that you'd like to add regarding, you know, your experience with yoga, Ayurveda, both at Mount Mandana and with private clients, and what you're doing in Guatemala?
The thing I would like to add is that most of us in our day and time have a vata vitiation, too much air, too much movement, too much space, too much everything. We're like all over the place. We can't make a decision. We can't settle down. And so if you can pay attention to that element, and what that element really responds well to is structure. So if you have a structured practice, if you have a structured time of day, you go to bed at the same time, you get up at the same time, you have breakfast, lunch, and dinner at the same time, that you have a regular routine. Vata begins to dissipate the minute you get a regular routine, that you're eating local, healthy, delicious foods, that your lunch is your biggest meal of the day, if at all possible, and your nightly meal is very light, that you never go to bed with food in your stomach, which means you must have finished your last meal 3 hours before bed and not put another thing in your belly. So some of the very basics, just to lower vata and to lower pitta, that aggravation of going to bed with food in your tummy, and then being very cautious with dairy, especially not in the evenings, if you have any kind of congestion, lowering kapha. So that's just a little tiny tidbits that everybody can use depending upon their dosha.
Yeah, well, your comment regarding the vata vitiation is, you know, definitely right on, considering, you know, the pace of modern life and, you know, all of the distractions that we're, especially mobile phones and that sort of thing. So
Yeah.
And those are great. Those are really great. Well, wonderful. I really appreciate you taking the time today.
Thank you, Noreen.
Where can our viewers and listeners find you? Your website or
YouTube is just Ginger Hooven. The YouTube is just Ginger Hooven. That's an N on the end, not Hoover. Hooven. Yes. And then if you want, anything is on mountmadonna.org. If you go there, on the bottom of the page, you'll find our free online offerings. We have Yoga Sutra class. We have a Bhagavad Gita class free online. We have a Saturday class, pranayama and meditation, breathing practices, everything on Saturdays. And then my classes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. And you'll find those at mountmadonna.org. You'll also find them here on my B&B, which is closed now due to the pandemic. But that's Casa San Juan. So www.casasanjuan.com.gt for Guatemala. If you don't put GT, you'll go to Honduras or somewhere. Okay. Yeah, so check out the offerings for online. I'm going to be doing a workshop in March. There are 5 Wednesdays in March, and there'll be 5 Wednesday mornings of doing each of the 5 elements with asana, mantra, mudra, pranayama, everything focusing on those 5 elements. That is a paid workshop, but it's also on the Mount Mandana site. So you should be able to look there. Yeah, so go to Mount Mandana and check out Casa San Juan.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. I'll include all of those links in the show notes.
Thank you, Noreen.
Thanks so much, Kamlesh.
It was great hanging out with you.
And wonderful.